Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Friday, January 19th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
Thanks, Rachel. And we'll head off with this article written by Thomas Geyer, reporter for the Quad City Times. Dinkins evidence rejection unlikely. Convicted murderer faces U.S. meth trial. A motion by convicted murderer Henry Earl Dinkins to suppress evidence of meth trafficking in a federal drug case will likely be denied after a hearing Wednesday. Dinkins' attorney and federal prosecutors presented their arguments on the motion Wednesday in the United States District Court in Davenport. After hearing arguments from both the prosecution and defense, Chief U.S. District Judge Stephanie Rose said she will review the video and audio of the traffic stop that occurred on April 25, 2019 in Bureau County, Illinois. But she instructed both Dinkins' attorney, Jack Dustheimer, and Assistant U.S. Attorney, Melissa Zeringer, to proceed with their cases as though the motion will be denied. Rose said she will issue an order at a later date. Dinkins, 51, attended the hearing dressed in an orange jail jumpsuit and orange slippers. He wore shackles on his ankles and his hands were cuffed in front of him, allowing him to write and communicate with Dustheimer. The federal case against Dinkins stems from a drug trafficking investigation initiated by the Scott County Sheriff's Office. The investigation includes evidence from the Bureau County traffic stop on Interstate 80 and evidence from a controlled buy on September 23, 2019, according to electronic records from U.S. District Court in Davenport. The federal indictment alleges Dinkins was trafficking in meth before he became a suspect in the disappearance of 10-year-old Brescia Terrell. Brescia was reported missing July 10, 2020. Her remains were found March 22, 2021 by fishermen in rural DeWitt. Dinkins was convicted in September 2023 of first-degree murder and first-degree kidnapping in conjunction with Brescia's death. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. A federal grand jury indicted Dinkins on the drug charges on December 8, 2020. The indictment alleges that from August 1, 2018 until September 23, 2019, Dinkins possessed with the intent to deliver 500 grams or more of a mixture containing methamphetamine. The indictment also alleges that on September 23, 2019, he distributed meth during a controlled buy by law enforcement. Dinkins was arrested on the charges on October 27, 2023. The case was unsealed the same day. During Wednesday's hearing, Dustheimer told the court that when he watched the video of the traffic stop that was taken by the squad camera of Illinois State Trooper Nicholas Griggs, he saw a Ford conversion van traveling at 48 miles an hour on Interstate 80. The minimum speed is 45 miles per hour. Dustheimer said that he saw the van come close to the center and fog lines, but never cross the lines. Griggs testified he pulled the van over because it had crossed the center and fog lines and that he suspected someone may have been driving under the influence. When he got the van pulled over, Griggs testified he could see the van swaying back and forth from side to side as though someone was running around inside. Griggs could not see inside the van as the windows were covered with mini blinds or curtains. Griggs also testified that when he ran the van to determine ownership, he found the van registered to neither Dinkins nor the driver. Dinkins got out of the passenger side holding a cell phone. Griggs stated that Dinkins was trying to ask where the next exit was because, as the back right tire was shredded and the belts were showing, Dinkins wanted to explain that the tire was the reason the van was swerving. Griggs instructed Dinkins to get back in the van. The driver of the van, Craig Davis Sims, had little interaction with Griggs. Eventually, Griggs called for a canine unit. The dog alerted to the van, and it was searched by the troopers. The trooper seized three large Ziploc bags from the van, filled with what the troopers initially thought were ecstasy pills. However, upon testing at the state crime lab, the pills turned out to be meth. Dinkins and Davis Sims were arrested, and each were eventually charged with two Class X felonies related to meth trafficking. On October 7, 2021, then Bureau County State's Attorney Gino Caffarini decided not to prosecute Davis Sims pursuant to an appellate court decision, and his case was dismissed according to electronic records of Bureau County Circuit Court. The meth case against Dinkins in Bureau County remains active. Each of the Illinois charges carry a prison sentence of 6 to 30 years. The canine handler, Sergeant Matthew Smith, answered questions from Dustheimer, Zeringer, and Rose about how canine air sniffs are conducted and how Smith knew the dog had registered the smell of drugs. Before ending the hearing, Rose stated that she had seen the video of the traffic stop from Griggs' squad car. She said she remembered seeing the van swerve over the center line and fog lines and said she would go back and look at the video again. Rose also said she found the testimony of Griggs and Smith to be credible. She added that since neither Dinkins nor Davis Sims possessed any evidence that they owned the van at the time, they did not have standing to contest the stop.
Also on the front page, Moore seeks transparency. This by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Government officials in Iowa who violate open meetings and records laws would face stiffer penalties under a bill introduced by a Bettendorf lawmaker. The bill, House File 2062, introduced by Representative Gary Moore, follows controversy in the city of Davenport over three settlement agreements with now former city employees, which were not voted on in a public meeting until months after the agreements were signed. Last week, a lawsuit was filed against the court. Last week, a lawsuit was filed asking the court to rule the city broke open meeting laws. I've been following the situation in Davenport City Hall regarding the collapse of the building downtown and the payout of $2 million to city employees and the apparent difficulty in individuals from accessing public records, and I'm tired of it, Moore said. Either we have open records and laws in Iowa that are enforceable, or we don't. And obviously, the penalties aren't sufficient to require people to comply. And so that was the impetus for my introduction of this bill. For a person who violated open meetings law, the bill would raise the civil fine from between $100 and $500 to between $1,000 and $5,000. If a violation is knowingly committed, the bill would increase the damages assessed from between $1,000 and $2,500 to between $10,000 and $25,000. The bill would also require elected and appointed officials to undergo an educational course on provisions of Iowa Code Chapters 21 and 22, the state's rules on open meetings and open records. Public records advocates that have a complaint can file a lawsuit and ask for relief from the courts or file a complaint with the Iowa Public Information Board, which very infrequently levies civil fines. In 8 years since the board was founded, until 2021, the board had levied monetary penalties just twice, according to the Des Moines Register. Historically, Moore said, the Public Information Board to date, if there's a violation, the Public Information Board will require training of chapters 21 and 22. And so I'm just saying, instead of waiting for education to be after a violation, let's require it of all elected and appointed officials up front as soon as they're elected. A third provision of the bill would lower the bar for removal from office. An official found to have violated the open meeting law could be removed if they've engaged in a previous violation of open meetings law. The current law requires damages to have been assessed against the official in the prior violation for them to be removed. Moore said, we're either going to be serious about opening records legislation or we're not, and it's time to put more teeth into the existing bill. In several recent high-profile cases, courts have sided with public meetings and records advocates. This past summer, a judge ruled the Central DeWitt Community School Board violated open meetings law when they illegally discussed board business in closed session in February of 2022. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds settled this past summer with journalists who sued her office for failing to respond to requests for records in 2020 and 2021 during the onset of the pandemic. The state's settlement came following a ruling from the Iowa Supreme Court that the case could continue, finding that open-ended delays in providing records violate the open records law. Because the case was not decided on its merits, the sections of Iowa law that require officials to pay civil fines for violating open records law and open the door for removal from office if repeat violations occur did not apply in that case.
Thanks, Rachel. Illinois legislators gear up to address migrant crisis. Thousands bust from Texas taxing Chicago resources. This written by Brendan Moore. The migrant crisis that has stretched the resources of the state and Chicago, as well as the political will of its leaders, was top of mind when legislators returned to Springfield this week for the start of their four-month legislative session. Lawmakers were only in the state capitol for a couple of days before skipping town, but they left with a better framework for how they might address the flood of asylum-seeking migrants who might have been bused to Chicago from the border at the behest of Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican. The state has already set aside more than $640 million to deal with the crisis, including $160 million announced in November to speed up the intake process, stand up temporary shelters, and move new arrivals into housing. The funds already spent likely will need to be accounted for in an appropriations bill. And then there's the discussion to be had about what to do moving forward as the influx is likely to continue this year. We want to make sure we're filling all the buckets that we've drawn from the order in order to make sure we're dealing with the crisis, said Governor J.B. Pritzker last week, speaking of the need to account for the money that's been spent. However, it appears that discussion will likely get roped into larger negotiations over the state budget later this spring. Senate President Don Harmon, in an interview with the Chicago Tribune this week, said there's no way we could advance an appropriation bill that dealt only with the newly arrived migrants. On the other side of the rotunda, House Speaker Chris Welch, Democrat from Hillside, announced on Wednesday the formation of a working group charged with finding legislative solutions to the crisis. The goal will be to find consensus among House Democrats before publicly proposing solutions. The recent influx of migrants into our state provides challenges and opportunities that require thoughtful encouragement and consensus building, Welch said. We know this issue will be an important part of conversations this session, which is why I'm putting together a diverse team with strong, relevant backgrounds ready to act as needed. Not in those discussions, at least for now, are super minority Republicans who voiced their displeasure for the amount of state resources expended to care for migrants. In lockstep with the White House, Governor Pritzker and the Democrats have propped up and expanded our sanctuary state policies to make Illinois the new Holiday Inn Express for illegal immigrants, said State Representative Chris Miller, Republican from Hinesboro, who chairs the arch-conservative Illinois Freedom Caucus. Some Republicans have proposed repealing portions of the Trust Act, the law signed by then-Governor Bruce Rauner in 2017 that generally prohibits state and local law enforcement from participating in federal immigration enforcement. Members of the Illinois Freedom Caucus, who recently traveled to the U.S.-Mexican border and up to Chicago to assess the situation, said Illinois should no longer be a sanctuary state for undocumented immigrants. The answer is quite simple. Secure the border, stop the invasion, suspend our sanctuary policies, and then start cleaning up the wreckage, said State Representative Brad Holbrook, Republican from Shelbyville. However, most of the migrants are not here illegally. Under U.S. law, those seeking asylum are generally allowed to remain in the country while waiting for their case to be considered in immigration court. Pritzker, responding to the calls to end Illinois' welcoming status, said Thursday they have zero to do with the current migration crisis that's occurring. He then repeated his criticism of Abbott. It is a challenge for Texas, there's no doubt about it, and for the nation, Pritzker said. And it ought to be addressed on a national basis, not on a piecemeal basis. And the governor of Texas causing problems state by state to the states that he chooses to send people to and concentrate them, and that ought to not be the way that we address this. Pritzker gives his budget address to lawmakers next month.
Also on the front page, Iowa House votes to back Israel. The story is accompanied by a photograph of pro-Palestine supporters in the rotunda on Thursday, January 18th. This is by Caleb McCullough. The Iowa House of Representatives passed a resolution Thursday declaring its support for Israel and its continued campaign in Gaza against Hamas, drawing protest from activists calling for a ceasefire in the ongoing war. The resolution passed by a voice vote in the House without a record of how each lawmaker voted. Republicans and many Democrats appeared to support the resolution, while a few no votes rang out from House Democrats. People who rallied against the vote on Thursday also shouted from the gallery after its passage before being removed by Iowa State Patrol officers. The pro-Palestinian activists said lawmakers should have called for a ceasefire rather than pass the resolution signaling unconditional support to Israel. The resolution says it is, quote, affirming the state of Iowa's support for the state of Israel and condemning the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7, 2023. In the resolution, lawmakers said they recognize Israel's right to act decisively and unilaterally in self-defense and to oppose any calls for a ceasefire. They further affirm Israel's right to pursue without interference or condemnation the elimination of Hamas and any other affiliated terrorist groups until Hamas and all such groups are permanently neutralized. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, told reporters on Thursday that the resolution was a continuation of the state of Iowa's long-running support for Israel as an ally of the U.S. He said the resolution had significant bipartisan support. When it comes to any terrorist organization, we're going to stand with our ally, what we have in Israel. So I don't think that today the action that we took was any different than we historically would have taken in my time in the legislature, Grassley said. No one wants to see any level of death and destruction that's going on overseas, but an unprovoked attack that we saw happen a couple months ago, also as an ally of that country, that's not something that we can just ignore, he added. Representative Sammy Sheets, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids and the only Arab American in the Iowa House, said during a press conference on Thursday that the majority Republicans did not ask for input from him or other Democrats on the language of the resolution. Sheets, who voted against the resolution, said he condemns all violence against the Israeli and Palestinian people, as well as anti-Semitism and anti-Arab rhetoric, but that continuing violence in the region would not resolve the conflict. He said, "This is not justice that will lead to a lasting peace. This is chaos and destruction. It has become clear that there is no military solution that will bring stability to Gaza. That's why I voted no on the Republican resolution this morning and continue to call for a ceasefire." More than 20,000 Palestinians have been killed since Israel launched its campaign against Hamas after the October 7th attacks in the country. Around 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, were killed in that attack. House Democrat leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights did not say how she voted on the resolution. "My members have every ability to have a conversation on their own outside this room of what needs to happen," she told reporters on Wednesday. "But what I'll tell you is the Israel-Hamas situation will not be solved through the Iowa legislature, and it's not really under our purview." About 24 people gathered in the Capitol Rotunda Thursday morning ahead of the vote to call for a ceasefire in Gaza, leading chants and impromptu speeches condemning Israel's actions and Iowa legislature. Danny Misyuk, a member of Iowa City Action for Palestine, came to the Capitol on Monday to show opposition to the resolution and support for Iowa's Palestinian population. Misyuk, who is Jewish, said the conflict and the reactions to it were deeply personal. "My religion and culture is being used to justify genocide, and I'm here to say that is not okay with me personally," Misyuk said. "We have Palestinian people here in Iowa, and they have family there, or they're affected here too, and we have to stand up for them and with them." Two Republican lawmakers proposed a bill on Thursday that would block students from receiving financial aid and cancel student groups' registrations if they endorse or promote terrorism or any group designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. government. The bill would give the Iowa Attorney General authority to determine whether a statement or action constitutes support for terrorism. Republican Representative Taylor Collins of Minneapolis, one of the bill's sponsors, said it was inspired by people supporting Hamas after the October 7th attacks. Representative Austin Harris, a Republican from Moulton, was the other sponsor of the bill. Collins said a statement that features the slogan "From the river to the sea" could be considered support for terrorism under the bill. The University of Iowa Democrats received backlash from the state party last year for posting a statement with the slogan, which some anti-hate groups consider to be anti-Semitic. Collins said, "I have a lot of confidence in the Attorney General's office in discerning free speech from actual support of terrorism, and it should be a conversation as the bill moves through the process."
Thanks, Rachel. Turning to local news page. We have an article written by Gannon Hannevold, a reporter for the Quad City Times. Figge names senior curators. In December, the Figge Art Museum named Vanessa Sage and Joshua Johnson as new senior co-curators. Both Johnson and Sage have been with the Figge for nearly a decade, each working their way up from entry-level positions in the years since, a Wednesday press release from the museum said. Sage arrived at the Figge as a curatorial intern in 2016, while Johnson started as a graduate assistant in 2015. Their years of experience, expertise, and knowledge have prepared them to lead the museum's efforts to bring in exhibitions and acquisitions that contribute to the vibrant cultural landscape of the Quad Cities, said Michelle Hargrave, Figge Executive Director and CEO, in the release. Sage studied at the University of Iowa, where she earned a BA in art history and later earned an MA in museum studies at Western Illinois University's Quad Cities campus. Since joining the Figge, Sage has curated exhibitions like Irma Renee Cohn, An Artist Rediscovered, John Bloom, Close to Home, Didier William, Lacoe, and Jane Gilmore, Breakfast on Pluto, the release said. Sage was born and raised in Davenport and attended the Figge growing up. More recently, he served as associate curator at the museum. Having grown up in Davenport, I'm deeply invested in positively impacting our community through art, she said in the release. I am proud of the work we do at the Figge, and I'm eager to expand that work in my new role. Johnson attended American University in Washington, D.C., where he earned an MFA in studio art. He has also completed graduate work in museum studies at Western Illinois University, the release said. Outside of his work at the Figge, Johnson has taught art and art history courses at Muscatine and Scott Community Colleges, the release said. This fall, he will start teaching courses at St. Ambrose University. I'm looking forward to exhibiting a fantastic historic collection in dynamic new ways while striving to make the collection and exhibits as relevant to our audience as possible, he said in the release. The release cited videos, performance documentation, 3D printing, and virtual reality as contemporary art forms Sage and Johnson aspire to include more of at the Figge. Their tenures as co-curators started on December 7th, 2023.
And just a short piece before we turn to the obituaries. The Center for Active Seniors, or CASI, C-A-S-I, in Davenport is closed for the remainder of the week due to a pipe that burst. On the automated voice messaging system for CASI, a recording Thursday said due to major flooding inside the facility caused by the busted pipe, the facility is closed for the remainder of the week. The facility hopes to reopen next week, the recording said. A status also was posted on CASI's Facebook Wednesday, stating that a water pipe connected to the facility's fire suppression system burst, which resulted in the flooding. The center immediately closed following the incident. The center is a nonprofit organization located at 1035 West Kimberly Road in Davenport. It provides support programming for seniors, an adult day service center for the elderly with dementia, and outreach services. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's time to turn to the obituaries in today's paper. I'll read the pendings and the first one, Jim, if you'll read the other two. Services pending, include services for the following: Shirley A. Schnickloff, 88, of Moline, who died on January 16th. Victor Dunan, age 65, of Rock Island, who died on Monday, January 15th. Carl West, age 74, of Moline, who passed away on Sunday, the 14th. Brady William Bonas, age 40, of Davenport, who died on Monday, January 15th. Albert or Bert Longmire, age 70, of Davenport, passed away Thursday, January 18th. The Reverend Ivan C. Schroeder, age 87, of Maquoketa, passed away Wednesday, January 17th. Ida M. Rummins, age 85, of Rock Island, passed away Wednesday, January 17th. Nancy DiPape Ballinger, age 90, of Rock Island, died on Thursday, January 18th. Andrea Marie Nelson Rose, age 63, of Rock Island, died on Sunday, January 14th. And Judy Clayton, age 80, of Davenport, Iowa, died Thursday, January 11th. The obituary that follows is for Katie Jean Hobbs. Katie Jean Hobbs, age 43, of Cedar Rapids, left this world peacefully on Monday, January 15th. In keeping with Katie's desire to live a simple life, so are her wishes concerning her death, as she will be cremated. There will be a gathering of family and friends on Monday, January 22nd, from 3 to 5 p.m., followed immediately with a celebration of life service at 5 p.m. at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. You are welcome to remember Katie by leaving your comments online at fryfuneralhome.com. Any donations that are received will be applied to the cost of her funeral. Katie was one of three children born to Nicholas, or Nick, and Pamela Hansen Hobbs. She entered this world on August 25, 1980, in Iowa City. Katie graduated from Bettendorf High School in 1999 and St. Ambrose College in 2004 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Marketing and Communication, and liked working in healthcare, and currently was working as an X-ray technician assistant at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Katie had a gift of singing and would often be remembered as singing around her home as she grew up. She was involved in many chorus ensembles in school. Katie had the lead role of her senior year in The Little Shop of Horrors and sang the national anthem at many events for Bettendorf High School. Katie loved animals and was a dog mom for her Yorkie, Bentley, and his friend Zoe. Katie was an adventurous soul, and every adventure she took was with passion and true interest. She traveled to Ireland for a semester while attending college. She sang in karaoke contests and won while there to earn a little celebrating coin. Katie loved the outdoors and moved to Breckenridge, Colorado for a year, where she was a dog mom to two beautiful labs. Katie enjoyed the challenges with city business and local government offices while working with the Quad City Chamber of Commerce. Katie's passion for reading was something to emulate. She often had two or more books going at once. She always claimed her happy place was a library. Katie chased a passion for running and completed multiple local races, including a half marathon. Katie's infectious laugh and huge heart will be missed the most. Katie is survived by her father, Nick, who lives in Iowa City, her sister Molly and her husband, Brent Chambliss, and her nieces of Tipton, her brother Jacob and his wife, Amber, and nieces and nephew of Port Byron, Illinois, her aunt, Lisa Delzell of Davenport, Uncle Gary and his wife, Joan of Davenport, her aunt, Karen Hansen of Iowa City, her uncle Todd and his wife Deb Hobbs of Norwalk, her aunt Sharon Ball of Morning Sun, many cousins, and her boyfriend Terry Gracie and his family. Katie was preceded in death by her mother Pam, who died on December 12, 2013. an infant brother, baby boy Hobbs, her grandparents, Ralph and Doris Hansen and Howard and Betty Hobbs, and her uncle David and cousin Ian Delzell.
And next we have Bernard C. Ben Huntington, 87, of Davenport, who died Monday, January 15th, at his home surrounded by family. Funeral services and mass of Christian burial for Ben will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, January 22nd, at Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church, 4105 North Division Street in Davenport. Burial will be in the Rock Island National Cemetery with military honors. Visitation will be Monday from 9:30 a.m. until Mass time in the gathering space at church. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital or Wounded Warriors. Bernard Carl Huntington was born on May 2, 1936, in Davenport, a son of Wilbur and Ellen Noel Huntington. He graduated from Davenport High School and proudly served in the Army. Ben was united in marriage to Ronna Lee McCaud on June 21, 1958, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They have shared over 65 years of marriage. Ben worked as a tool grinder and senior repairman at the Rock Island Arsenal for over 30 years, retiring in 1991. Ben was always available to help and wouldn't stop until the project was finished. He enjoyed fishing and spent many summers at their family cabin in Minnesota. Ben also enjoyed competing with his neighbor and son Marty on who would get their yard mowed or snow shoveled first. Those left to honor Ben's memory are his wife, Ronna Lee, children and their spouses, Lynette, Robin, spouse Mike, Yvette, spouse Tom, Mark, spouse Madine, Martin, spouse Jennifer, Glenn, and Michelle, spouse Don. 11 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, 4 great-great-grandchildren, and a sister, Vera, spouse Larry, sisters-in-law, Sandy, and Marty. He was preceded in death by his parents and siblings, Jean, Dick, Edward, Rosemary, George, Walter. May they rest in peace. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting www.hmdfuneralhome.com. And then we have Alvin Cloda. Alvin E. Cloda, 93, of Moline, passed away Monday, January 15th at Clarissa Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. A mass of Christian burial will be 11 o'clock a.m. on Monday, January 22nd at Christ the King Church in Moline. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Burial will be at the National Cemetery in Rock Island with military honors conducted by the American Legion Post 246. Memorials can be made to Christ the King Church, Honor Flight of the Quad Cities, National Czech and Slovak Museum in Cedar Rapids, or St. Peter's and Paul's Church, our chapel in Solon. Al was born April 24th, 1930, in Solon, Iowa, the son of Edward and Stella Molly Cloda. He married Ruth Amdor on December 28th, 1957, in Messina, Iowa. Al was a U.S. Air Force veteran, having served during the Korean War. He obtained his agricultural engineering degree from Iowa State University in 1958. Al worked at John Deere Spreader Works, retiring from John Deere Plow and Planter. He later worked for the U.S. Department of Army at the Rock Island Arsenal and Mel Foster. Al was a member of Christ the King Church, where he served as the usher and funeral acolyte. Knights of Columbus Father Bader Assembly, American Society of Agricultural Engineers, Toastmasters, and registered professional engineer in the state of Illinois. Al also served as president at ARC of the Quad Cities. He enjoyed gardening, woodworking, camping, and collecting. Survivors include his wife, Ruth, children, John Cloda, Moline, Mary Jane Cloda, Des Moines, Michael, spouse Katharina Cloda in Tyler, Texas, Thomas, spouse Troy Cloda, Washington, D.C., and several grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his infant son, Anthony, and two sisters. Condolences may be left at www.raffertyfunerals.com.
It's time to turn to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. The first editorial is by Maggie Tinsman, who is a retired Iowa State Senator, Secretary of the Iowa Network Against Human Trafficking and Slavery, and Chair for Breaking Traffic Advisory Committee. It's titled Human Trafficking Epidemic Grips Iowa and Quad Cities. Human trafficking is a grave and pervasive crime that involved the exploitation of individuals through force, fraud, or coercion for various purposes, including forced labor, sexual exploitation, and involuntary servitude. Indeed, traffickers are increasingly using social media platforms to identify and target victims remotely with the internet. Sex trafficking, a particularly heinous form of exploitation, involves 85% females facing the grim reality of being coerced into prostitution or other forms of sexual servitude. Beyond this, forced labor casts a dark shadow across various industries such as agriculture, manufacturing, construction, and domestic work. Alarmingly, individuals under 18 years of age are particularly vulnerable, facing a higher risk of forced labor or commercial sexual exploitation. The true extent of human trafficking is likely underestimated due to its clandestine nature, the ability to hide it in rural areas, and the reluctance of victims to come forward. Many instances go unreported, and victims often live in fear, making it challenging for law enforcement to compile accurate statistics. In 2023, Family Resources, through their organization Breaking Traffic in Davenport, served 368 victims, highlighting the pressing need for action. They received some funds from the federal government, but nothing from the state of Iowa. So as funds diminish from the federal government, they have to stop serving survivors. Disturbingly, child sex trafficking in incidents more than doubled in Iowa from 2020 to 2021, with the state now at the center stage of this deplorable crime. Iowa is not going to be able to stop these heinous acts if we don't make a significant investment in the programs serving victims of these criminals, as 15 other states are doing. To address this urgent issue, the Iowa Network Against Human Trafficking and Slavery is calling on the Iowa legislature to allocate $5 million in state funds for human trafficking victim services in the 2025 Justice Systems budget. Without state support, organizations like Family Resources face limitations and cannot provide rehabilitative, essential services to the victims. The public, that is you and I, are urged to take immediate action. 1. Call or write your Iowa State Senator and State Representative urging them to allocate $5 million for human trafficking victim and survivor services in the 2025 budget. 2. Recognize that this funding could assist 26 different social service networks across the state in supporting survivors once rescued from human trafficking. In the face of the sinister underworld of human trafficking, a collective effort is needed to curb this epidemic. State funding is crucial for the operational support of Iowa's human trafficking victim services providers, ensuring consistent and effective assistance to survivors. The urgency of this call to action is underscored by the abominable nature of human trafficking, a dark stain on the fabric of humanity. Every effort must be marshaled to thwart this crime, and the community's involvement is paramount. Thank you for joining the fight against human trafficking. Your participation is immensely appreciated in the pursuit of justice and protection for the vulnerable. Together we can make this happen. Again, that was written by Maggie Tinsman, retired Iowa State Senator.
Thanks, Rachel. The other opinion piece today is Only Israel Required to Fight a Just War. This written by John Donald O'Shea. He is from Moline and a retired circuit judge and a regular columnist. As I have watched the pro-Palestinian tumult in the streets of our great cities, I have wondered how many Americans have taken time to read Hamas's founding document, the Covenant of the Islamic Resistance Movement, 18 August of 1988. In the covenant's preface, we are told, Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before it. Article 6 states the Islamic Resistance Movement is a distinguished Palestinian movement whose allegation is to Allah and whose way of life is Islam. It strives to raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine. Article 7 concludes, the day of judgment will not come about until Muslims fight the Jews, killing the Jews, when the Jew will hide behind stones and trees. The stones and trees will say, O Muslims, O Abdullah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. Hamas believes that a land once conquered by the armies of Islam is forever consecrated to Muslim generations until the Day of Judgment. Palestine is an Islamic holy possession, land consecrated for Muslim generations until Judgment Day. This is the law governing the land of Palestine in the Islamic Sharia law, and the same goes for any land the Muslims have conquered by force, because during the times of Islamic conquest, the Muslims consecrated these lands to Muslim generations till the Day of Judgment. In Article 13, Hamas rejects all compromise, all peaceful coexistence. Initiatives and so-called peaceful solutions and international conferences are in contradiction to the principles of the Islamic Resistance Movement. Abusing any part of Palestine is abuse directed against a part of religion. Now and then the call goes out for the convening of an international conference to look for ways of solving the Palestinian question. There is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. Initiatives, proposals, and international conferences are all a waste of time and vain endeavors. The Palestinian people know better than to consent to having their future rights and fate toyed with. Article 15 sets out the means Hamas intends to imply to achieve its end. The day that enemies usurp part of Muslim land, jihad becomes the individual duty of every Muslim. In the face of the Jews' usurpation of the Palestine, it is compulsory that the banner of jihad be raised. It is necessary that scientists, educators, teachers, information and media people, as well as the educated masses, especially the youth and sheikhs of the Islamic movement, should take part in the operation of awakening the masses. It is necessary to instill in the minds of the Muslim generations that the Palestinian problem is a religious problem and should be dealt with on this basis. On October 7, 2023, Hamas attacked the civilian population in Israel in clear violation of the laws of war. Roughly 1,200 Israelis, including some foreign nationals, were murdered. The figure includes the women who were raped and children who were slaughtered. 250 more, including the elderly, women, and children, were taken hostage. So what is Israel supposed to do? Abide by the Geneva Convention as to Palestinian non-combatants, while Hamas makes mockery of the convention, revels in killing elderly Israeli women, pregnant women, and infants, and exultantly send iPhone videos of its atrocities to its supporters. What Hamas did is pure evil. Hamas calls for the obliteration of Israel and the killing of every Jew, for every Muslim to engage in jihad. Hamas rejects all initiatives, proposals, and international conferences as a waste of time and vain endeavors, and then wonders why Israel responds with total war. Imagine living in a lawless part of town and having a neighbor who has repeatedly and publicly threatened to kill you and your family. That neighbor then breaks into your home, rapes your wife, beheads her and your infant daughter, and kidnaps your two-year-old son. Not satisfied, he publicly announces he still plans to kill you too. What is Israel supposed to do with an enemy who will not negotiate peace, who calls for jihad to obliterate Israel, and for the killing of every last Jew who will not abjure his religion and income and become Muslim? The New York Times reports on December 27, 2023, Hamas and its affiliates have continued to fire rockets at Israel nearly every day, striking some of the country's biggest cities. Hamas and other armed groups have fired about 12,000 rockets from Gaza into Israel. Hamas hides its rocket launchers in Gaza among the civilian population and fires its rockets at the civilian population throughout Israel. Hamas claims the right to torture, rape, and murder all Israeli non-combatants. It beheads women and children, takes hostages, refuses to negotiate. The Jews, it seems, are required to love their Palestinian neighbors as they love themselves. Hamas requires the Palestinians wage murderous jihad against every Jew, until Israel is obliterated and every Jew is killed. What standing does Hamas have to demand that Israel observe all rules of war when Hamas pisses on every one of them? One, it is available online in full at Yale Law School's Avalon Project, an online library of original documents dealing with law, history, and diplomacy.
We're nearly at the end of our hour, but just a few notes from the sports page about what to watch. Iowa Hawkeyes men's wrestling Friday at 7, men's basketball versus Purdue Saturday at 1, and women's basketball at Ohio State on Sunday at 11. Iowa State Cyclones at TCU, men's basketball on Saturday at 1, and women's basketball at TCU Saturday at 1, and at Kansas on January 24th. the Quad City Storm versus Knoxville Friday and Saturday at 7:10 p.m. And, of course, there's a playoff game tomorrow on Saturday, the Green Bay Packers versus the San Francisco Giants. That's at 7:15 p.m. on Saturday. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.